Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Thanks for joining us again on another episode of GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast. And for this episode, we are joined by Maria Gabriela Palacio, and she is an assistant professor in development studies at the Latin American Studies Program, Institute for History. Now, her work looks at conventional approaches to economic development by engaging with some questions of identity, difference, and power. Now, situated within development studies and informed by political economy, anthropology of the state, and sociology of gender and race, Maria's work seeks to understand how social policy shapes social and political entities. And most of her empirical research has focused on Ecuador, though she's also written more broadly about Latin America. And this week, Maria is joining us on GDP to bring us up to speed about what is going on in Ecuador today. Maria, bienvenidos a GDP.
Muchas gracias. Thank you, Robert, for this invitation.
No, it's fantastic to connect with you and the work that you've been doing, but also your commentaries that you published recently in The Conversation about what's happening in Ecuador at the moment. There's so much fraughtness over security and fears and gangs. Even the famous case of the gang taking over the television station. A lot of people have questions about what's happening in Ecuador at the moment. Can you bring us up to speed?
Sure, I'll try my best. And certainly, Ecuador was known as a relatively peaceful country in the region. But over the past months, we've made it to global news. Over the past weeks, we had an intrusion of armed men during a live TV broadcast. Also, a very mediatic gang leader, alias Fito, escaped the prison system, showing also, you know, the difficulties to gain control of the prison system. And actually, the prosecutor who was in charge of investigating the TV broadcast raid was assassinated last week. But, you know, these are the most spectacular events that just give a glimpse into the situation of insecurity in the country.
And where has this come from? I mean, this has not been Ecuador's situation in past years and decades.
I think that is the question we are all asking. Where did this come from? And I think one can make a sense of it only by looking at global, regional, and domestic issues. To give you a bit of the global take on this issue, I think that it is important to mention that Ecuador is a country located between Colombia and Peru. And Colombia is known as the world's most important producer and exporter of cocaine. In recent years, actually, most of the production has moved to the south of Colombia, the north of Ecuador. And that is also, you know, strongly related to this increase in cocaine production. And at the moment, it is estimated that between 70 and 80% of the cocaine produced in southern Colombia enters Ecuador and then moves in global markets. So you have this element. And of course, that has to do with the geopolitical location of Ecuador. The Ecuadorian ports are very strategically located in the South Pacific. For instance, the port of Manta is very important because it's the center of industrial fishing. And this is a great activity, actually, to disguise the refueling of ships that traffic illicit substances and then go to Central America. And also the port of Guayaquil plays a very important role in the trade of illicit substances because, as many will know, Ecuador is a major banana exporter. And actually, a lot of the drug trafficking goes in these containers carrying bananas. Actually, 40% of the drugs seized in Ecuadorian ports have been using banana shipment for that matter. So, you know, that has to do with, you know, the global trade of cocaine and how slowly but certainly demand has shifted more to European markets away from the U.S. It is also very convenient that Ecuador is a dollarized country. Ecuador adopted the U.S. dollar as its currency in the 2000s following a banking crisis. Now, that makes it very easy for different, you know, illicit traders to conduct money laundering activities in the country, because despite being a dollarized economy, actually, the levels of financial debt are rather low. So a lot of money still flows in informal financial markets. So makes it a very convenient place to also, you know, move around these illicit funds. So that has to do a bit more with, you know, the global trade and global finance related to illicit activities. But then we have a regional reshaping of gangs operating in the region. So, for instance, all these activities are operated with the cooperation of international and local gangs. International gangs work like any other multinational corporation, right? They go to places in which costs can be reduced, being these transaction costs are similar, and that the issues I mentioned before can largely explain why they had moved to Ecuador. But it also, you know, has to do with the fact that a lot of these activities are also working in cooperation with local gangs. So regional gangs affiliated with regional Mexican cartels, such as the Sinaloa cartel, one of the most important cartels that is active in Ecuador, and a mafia from Albania, actually, play a crucial role in securing routes for transportation of drugs to markets in Europe, in cooperation also with local gangs. And the local gangs operate more like the front line of these criminal operations. And they form synergies with economic sectors such as exporters, financial sector, and of course the state, which makes it quite complicated.
What a mix. And there's so much going on here that, like, as you say, is regional. It's not just the circumstances within the country, but the bananas. I'm so glad you mentioned that. I was doing some work recently that said that, you know, bananas are the target vehicle, I guess, for narcotics, because there's so much of a demand and they're going to expire so quickly. So by putting in narcotics with the bananas, you can't catch it all. And that pressure to make sure the bananas get to market before they expire is what facilitates that trade. It's just mind blowing.
Totally. And it tells you so much about the difficulties in establishing a clear division between licit and illicit activities, which I think is at the core of the matter when we look at the expansion of drug-related violence in the region.
Right. And the borders as well. I mean, it's, as you say, Ecuador just resting between Peru and Colombia. You know, there's a few key borders that go back and forth. I recall, you know, once upon a time, I was traveling up to Guayaquil from Tumbes in Peru, and passing through the border town of Huachilias. And I remember that was quite a scenario to getting across the border. But, you know, there's a lot of jungle territory. There's lots of Amazonia out there, and I'm guessing it's too porous of a border for Ecuadorian officials to monitor any sort of trafficking of cocaine from Colombia coming into the country.
Most certainly, you have the aspect of geography playing an important role, because being a relatively small country in the region, it's extremely diverse. And some areas can be quite hostile, which makes it very easy to, you know, keep some activities quite secluded. But, you know, next to this, I've been doing research on informal economies for about a decade. So you also have this component of informality that was the modus operandi of many of these, you know, regions that kind of created a conducive environment for illicit activities when something as harsh as a pandemic hit. Yeah. Many of these regions were facing high rates of unemployment, children and adolescents completely neglected, out of school, without a possibility to work. So it is in this void of the state that you have the perfect conditions for gang violence to actually explode at the speed and with severity that it has done it over the past months.
That's incredible. So in this bigger picture that you're drawing out here, I mean, can we ask the question, why is this happening in Ecuador right now? What has made this perfect storm come together? Partially for the covers of the pandemic, as you say, but are there other factors that are making this such a reality in 2024?
Yeah, you have a combination of the pandemic. I think that's very important to stress because the levels of precarity and poverty in Ecuador were quite dramatic. A lot of the social assistance programs set up in place to curb the effects of the lockdowns were really narrow and did not reach most vulnerable populations, particularly informal workers or really peripheral areas in the country. So then you have, you know, something that explains these high levels of precarity. And if you think of the location of these illicit activities and violence, it's mostly border areas and coastal areas, which also, you know, were particularly hit economically by the pandemic. But, you know, next to this, you have a slow but persistent attack on the state. I think we can talk about a pretty strong neoliberal turn from 2018 onwards, in which, for instance, Ecuador is the only country in the region that does not have a Ministry of Justice. This was completely dismantled in 2018, part of it being in a context of austerity measures following IMF recommendations. But, you know, the Ministry of Justice was in charge of managing the prisons. And now our prisons basically are sites of precarity. Really, there's this collective disaffection towards what happens in prisons. There's overcrowding. They're having riots requesting better conditions. The inmates have, you know, many times got the attention of human rights organizations due to the conditions they face. And importantly, also, these prisons have also become hubs for local gangs to recruit new members. So you have somehow misguided security policy that tended to march towards a mano dura, heavy-handed approach. And that led to an increasing prison population and unknowingly actually facilitating the recruitment of more people into these gangs. Because that's at the core of the last wave of violence, regaining control of prisons and basically different gangs disputing the territorial control of the different areas of the prison system.
This is unbelievable. This is the upside down world where, you know, prisons, which are supposed to be detention and reform for criminals, have now transitioned into kind of being the hubs of the network where this whole activity is organized, essentially.
Certainly. And many of us are quite worried that actually the current approach to this, you know, level of violence is even more securitization of policies. Following the last events over the last weeks, the president decreed something called a non-international armed conflict. Basically, this allows the government to militarize the society. Many see this like our president Noboa is following the footsteps of Bukele, which is, you know, a central figure in terms of security responses in the region, and very, very contested, very controversial figure also. So basically, this approach involves imposing continuous states of emergency, building these massive prisons and combating, quote unquote, terrorism in a society that is paralyzed with fear. So of course, it resonates with population that is desperate for an immediate solution to the insecurity they face. But we have enough evidence of what has happened in Colombia and Mexico, for instance, that actually the militarization of society leads to even more violence because it's a two-way effect. So gangs will also be ready to fight back with, you know, even more violence and, you know, with stronger tactics. And at the end, you have basically civil society in this crossfire, with many civilians, you know, being at the end of these structures of oppression and violence.
And that's, you know, looking more globally at how that habit repeats itself. It's something where you see just how fragile that civil society is to these pressures that then create a rise in gang violence in this way. So, you know, in order for gangs to do what they want to do, they have to recruit. So what's making it so easy for them to recruit in Ecuador right now?
Yeah, I think that the key concept to understand what makes it so easy for gangs to recruit adolescents in particular, you know, we're talking about populations between 12 and 19 years old joining these gangs, has to do with the structural violence. So basically, you have areas in which indigenous populations, Afro-Ecuadorians, Montuvians, which is also an ethnic group within Ecuador, and the younger demographic, particularly teenagers, are at the sharp end of socio-political structures. So let us break it down into, first, the effects of the pandemic that I again mentioned is very important. The COVID-19 pandemic led to a closure of educational institutions in Latin America. And actually, Ecuador was one of the countries that had one of the longest periods without children attending school. Actually, this has led to a growth of something we call now ninihood. So basically, you have students that neither study nor work, and they can be easily recruited into these gangs and armed groups, lacking any other alternative. Next to these, you also have something that is more of a cultural phenomenon that I would like to stress. There is this romanticization of even this morbid curiosity for narco-politics and narco-culture. We see it on media, we see it on social media also, you know, like TikTok, WhatsApp groups, Facebook, that elevate these gang leaders as mediatic figures and provide a sense of some sort of belonging. So that also, that glorification of these figures might be quite appealing to young people that are not attending school, do not have a lot of tools actually to navigate this information, and they can be easily co-opted into these gangs. So we have the lack of education, we have the glorification of narco figures. But also, you know, many students or former students have abandoned school simply because they are scared. Over the past 5 years, about 20,000 children and adolescents in the province of Esmeraldas in the north of Ecuador drop out from school. This is a province where roughly 34% of the Afro-descendant population is concentrated. And it's the province that at the moment faces the highest rates of violence and homicides per 100,000 inhabitants. So this is also a place in which you find many of these adolescents, mostly boys, being portrayed as the perpetrators of violence, while many of them are actually the victims of it. Actually, and you know, this is again connected to cocaine production. Basically, the cocaine corridor runs through the province of Esmeraldas. So actually, the increase in cocaine production has, you know, coincided with this increase in violence against adolescents in that province. But you know, something that is interesting, and again, this is part of the contradictions of the security policies. There has been also, you know, an increase in drug consumption. So because so far we have talked about these global and regional networks of, you know, international trade of illicit substances, but actually there is also a substantial increase in drug consumption within the country. Mm. So what happens is that criminal organizations often pay for the transportation of drugs internationally using the same substances they traffic. So this increases micro-traffic, and many of these organizations target young individuals that then get caught into this dynamic, are users of these substances, and then they're also joining the gangs. And that's why I'm framing this as a problem of structural violence, because if you actually go deeper into the drivers that lead to this rapid recruitment into these gangs, they're related with social exclusion, state neglect, and issues of marginalization.
Yeah, and that's such a key point, that to produce and reproduce structural violence in this way, you need to have these upstream factors at play. It's not just the muscle and might of a gang that physically overthrows a state. It requires these preconditions of opportunity and this vulnerability that you're painting out, especially just how important the role is of targeted youth and targeted male youth to take these extremely high risks in what is promised some sort of return for doing so. Again, really reflects just something we've seen all over the world, from, you know, El Salvador to gangs in conflict zones in East Africa. Like this pattern seems to be just repeating. And I guess my question is, what is there to do about it? Is there something in the context of Ecuador that we can do about this and look at some sort of a option for either intervention or finding a way to dismantle this system?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question, because I think we're better equipped to say what not to do. I think I
right,
mentioned
exactly.
the aspect of militarization that has been proven to be counterproductive and actually generate even more violence. Also, you have the example of El Salvador, which is, again, super controversial, because though it has managed to curb homicide rates, it had also come at the cost of political freedoms and civic liberties. And I struggle to think that a region cannot deal with this crisis without compromising its democracy and the basic democratic values, or its sovereignty, because then you can move to the other set of policies that actually declare this quote-unquote war on drugs, war on terror, and actually invite for more foreign intervention. It has been heavily debated in the case of Ecuador how the U.S. has been invited to intervene in this security crisis. And that poses questions about the sovereignty of the country. And it basically seems that this war on drugs is being fought across borders, and it has just moved across the region. And Ecuador just happens to be, incidentally, the last place where this war is being fought, but not necessarily with the intention to solve it, to de-escalate it. Mm. So it is very difficult to actually point out at an immediate solution to this. Though I think it is important that we recover the monopoly of violence, you know, in social sciences, we regard that as a defining feature of the state. And with the presence of these gangs that have this level of coordination that can set up this chaos overnight in a country during a state of emergency, I think that is essential to recover that monopoly of force, And that's why you can understand the decision of deeming this as an internal armed conflict. But that needs an exit strategy. Otherwise, you end up with a very strong military, and we have a long pedigree of how that can go wrong in the region. So you need an exit strategy and actually work on recovering the bases. We can talk about social protection, education measures to provide some real safety net for these populations to not opt for these desperate options of joining gangs, but actually have a livelihood, have state-provided income support in the face of systemic shocks such as the pandemic or other things that might happen. But it's very difficult because the second set of sort of solutions or policies that I'm suggesting will not take place or will not see the benefits immediately. And when you are every day waking up to this gruesome news that just show you the display of violence, you don't want to hear about democracy. You don't want to hear about welfare. You just want that insecurity to stop. So it makes it very difficult for governments not to adopt this mano dura response and really go with just the punitive approaches and the display of force. But I think that in the 21st century, we can do much better than just meeting force with more violence.
Amen to that. And thank you, Maria, for, you know, not just saying what we shouldn't do, but part of things that we should do. I think that's, those are the kind of brave suggestions that we need to really take seriously and try to find the moments when this has happened in the past, when people have made small successes on providing these opportunities that don't just compete with attractiveness to gangs, but actually overrule them. And try to think about new ways of going forward, because it's so spot on to, you know, the militarization response to narco trafficking just feeds the beast in many ways. And that doesn't help anybody in the end.
Yes. And also I think it's very important to see this not only as a domestic problem, this is not only Ecuador's issue. I think there is a place for regional and global solutions. Illicit economies are highly profitable, and they exist in these local, regional, and global networks. They operate next to legal trade channels, or thanks to them. They operate through pretty legal financial channels too, and they can even feed financialization. There is a whole value chain of cocaine, not only production, distribution, but also consumption. So when looking at this Ecuadorian case, I'm, you know, also looking at the global political economy of insecurity and how it's perpetuating these sites of violence without necessarily placing them in the global architecture, and how other economies, other sectors, are also accountable for this explosion of violence.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, Maria, thank you so much for joining us on GDP. Your insights are certainly profound on the situation, and your approach to addressing these questions through the rubric of structural violence is something that I would sincerely hope that listeners to this podcast, the students, the teachers, the policymakers, really do take to heart, because that's where the effort, I would say, needs to be directed to better understand that. And thank you so much indeed for joining us on GDP, and all the best to you until we speak to you next time.
Thank you so much, Robert.